Physicist Howard Wiseman of the Griffith University in Australia, whose group published their work in Nature Physics last October. A laser, in essence, is a megaphone for light. The word itself, originally an acronym, reflects this function, light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Send in a photon of the right frequency, and the laser makes copies of it, multiplying the original signal. These photon clones exit the laser in sync with each other, traveling in phase. As the experts call it, you can think of it this way. Each photon is a wave with its crest and trough lined up with its neighbor, marching together in lockstep out of the laser. This contrasts with most other light sources, such as your reading lamp or even the sun, which both emit photons that disperse randomly. The longer photons stay in sync, the more monochromatic the light. The color of a light source corresponds to the wavelength of its photon, with green light spanning roughly 500 to 550 nanometer range, for example. For multiple photons to stay in sync for a long time, their wavelength must line up very precisely, meaning the photons need to be as close to one color as possible. Let me drop for a sec. This synchrony of laser photons is known as temporal coherence. It is one of the device's most useful properties. Many technologies make use of laser light's ridiculously fast and steady rhythm, its wave pattern repeating at hundreds of trillions of times a second for visible lasers. For example, this property underpins the world's most precise timekeeping devices known as optical lattice clocks. But photons gradually lose sync after they leave the laser. How long they stick together is known as the laser's coherence time. In 1958, physicists Arthur Shallow and Charles Pounds estimated the coherence time of a perfect laser. This is a common physicist design strategy. Consider the most ideal version of something before building a far more lacking real-world device. They found that an equation thought to represent an ultimate coherence time limit for lasers set by the laws of physics. Physicists refer to this as the Shallow-Townes limit. The two new papers find that the Shallow-Townes limit is not the ultimate limit. In principle, it should be possible to build lasers which are significantly more coherent, said the physicist David Pecker of the University of Pittsburgh, who led the other group. Their paper currently is under peer review and is posted as a preprint on ARXIV's website. Both groups argue that the Shallow-Townes limit rests on assumptions about the lasers that are no longer true. Shallow and Townes basically thought that of a laser as a hollow box in which photons multiply and leave at a rate proportional to the amount of light inside the box. Put another way, the photons flow out of Shallow and Townes' laser like water drains from a hole in a barrel. Water flows faster when the barrel is fuller and vice versa. Let me drop for a sec. But Wiseman and Pecker both found that if you place a valve on the laser to control the rate of the photon flow, you can actually make a laser coherent for a much longer time than Shallow Townes' limit. Wiseman's paper takes this a step further, allowing for these photon-controlling valves. This team re-estimates the coherence time limit for the perfect laser. Quote, we show that ours is the ultimate quantum limit, said Wiseman, meaning a true physical limit dictated by quantum mechanics. Shallow and Townes estimate, while not the fundamental restriction on laser physicists originally thought, was reasonable for its time, said Wiseman. No one had any means for precisely controlling the flow of light out of the laser in a way that Wiseman and Pecker have now proposed. But today's lasers are a different story. Physicists can now control light and with a multitude of devices developed by the budding quantum computing industry. Pecker has teamed up with physicist Michael Hatridge, also of the University of Pittsburgh, to bring the new laser design to life. Hatridge's expertise involves building circuits out of superconducting wire for storing and controlling microwave frequency photons. They plan to build a microwave emitting laser, known as a maser, for programming qubits inside of quantum computers made of superconducting circuits. Though building this new maser will take years of work and troubleshooting, Hatridge said that they have all the tools and the knowledge to make it possible. That's why we're excited about it, because it's just another engineering project, Hatridge said. Wiseman is looking for collaborators to build this design, also a Maser. I would really like this to happen, he said, but I recognize that it's a long-term goal. The designs are completely feasible, said physicist Stephen Tozerd of the National University of Singapore, who is not involved in either of the new papers. However, Pecker and Wiseman's work may not directly lead to a useful commercial laser, according to Tozerd, who points out that builders of lasers do not commonly use shallow town's limits to direct their design, so overturning that limit could be more of a theoretical advantage than an engineering one, he said. Let me drop for a sec. Curiously, the two new designs also contradict another conventional wisdom about lasers. The devices do not produce light via so-called stimulated emission, which makes up the S and the E in the acronym, laser. Stimulated emission is a type of interaction between light and matter in which a photon impinges upon an atom and stimulates the atom to emit an identical photon. If we imagine a laser as a box of light as before, a laser that amplifies light using stimulated emission multiplies the signal proportional to the amount of light already in the box. Another type of laser invented in 2012, known as a super radiant laser, also does not use stimulated emission to amplify light, according to Tozerd. The idea of a laser has outgrown its name. It is no longer exclusively a light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Of course, many such examples exist in the English language. The change in meaning is known as a semantic shift and is common whenever new technology is involved, according to linguist Micah Eisner of the Ohio State University. Ships still sail across the ocean, even when no actual sails are involved. You can still dial someone's number even though your phone doesn't have a dial anymore. Even though a word's etymology, its origin, certainly gives it a starting point, it does not determine its destiny forever going forward, linguist Brian Joseph of the Ohio State University said in this report. As Cold War goals transition to the 21st century, lasers have evolved too. They've been around long enough to integrate into nearly all aspects of modern life. They can correct human vision. They can read your grocery's barcode. They can etch computer chips. They can transmit video files from the moon. They can help steer self-serving cars and set the mood at psychedelic ragers. And now the laser could be reinvented once again. A 60-year-old device remains a symbol of a sci-fi future. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, one last rather weird story for you before I call it a night. The next story might strike some as morbid, but, you know, it's just part of the great circle of life. Death is inevitable, but the Seattle-based company Recompose is giving people a new way to exit this mortal coil, having their remains laid in a tube of mulch and soil and letting bacteria turn them back into compost in a month's time. After having opened their doors earlier this winter, Recompose is now fully getting to work and composting dearly departed clients. Recompose has been in the works for years, led by founder and CEO Katrina Spade. In 2019, Spade's efforts convinced the state to legalize the use of human composting as a form of body disposal alongside cremation and the standard graveside burial. By last November, Recompense had started taking on pre-orders for their service, and in late December, it officially began composting. As of mid-January, according to the Seattle Times, the company has 8 of its 10 available vessels currently occupied. The company told Earther in November that it had lined up 350 pre-composed clients, all ready to use the service whenever their time to meet their maker comes. Two other composting funeral homes, Herlin Forest and Return Home, have been approved to operate in that same state and are expected to open soon. Human composting, more politely called natural organic reduction, is thought to be a much greener and energy-efficient way of disposing of remains. Recompose method works by entombing the body in a capsule filled with wood chips, alfalfa, and straw, along with bacteria that love to chow on organic matter. Over a 30-day period, which requires the occasional turning of the capsule, the bacteria turn our bodies into productive fertilizer. These remains are then stored in the curing bin for a few additional weeks. It's a much lighter footprint than embalming, which uses toxic chemicals, and cremation, which emits carbon dioxide and other pollutants. Let me drop for a sec. A green burial with recompose is estimated to cost about $5,500 in total, though costs are higher for out-of-state. That's more expensive than cremation, but on a par or even a bit less expensive than the average burial. Afterwards, families have the choice to have the remains sent to them or donated to a local environmental project in the state. The state has mandated certain safety measures for the practice, such as not allowing people who have died of tuberculosis, a hardy bacteria that can be easily survive in soil, or prion disease, be composted. Recompose and other companies will also be expected to regularly test the soil that's produced for worrying pathogens and chemicals like arsenic, lead, and mercury. Still, there is not expected to be much of a mess to worry about. An official from Puget Sound Clean Air Agency told Seattle Times that the emissions and smells from human composting will likely be far less bothersome than what they see from cremations, demolishing buildings filled with asbestos, and growing cannabis. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, very well. I've done my little thing. It's 10:14 and almost time for Paul and the SpaceNet report. Once again, I want to remind everyone, if you have any technical questions and you can't get on the radio yourself, if you have any topics you'd like to hear discussed, if you have any puzzles of a technical nature, you know, something interesting, share them with me and I'll hopefully be able to share them with everyone else out there. If you want me to poke Paul on the shoulder and tell him to look at some kind of space-related news or YouTube and comment on it, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to all the stories that I mentioned and more is available on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. And always remember that Mike KC2NJI has archives of the technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. And once again, as always, want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Wanted to thank Andy for Andy's Corner. And I'll be back to tie this up in a bow, but it is now time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet Report.
Very good, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. By the way, if anybody thinks of any questions for Roy, he's always here. This is the TechNet, so you can always stop me and get your question in so you don't have to wait until next week. The net, we didn't have the net last week, so a couple of these topics are delayed a little bit. Like, for instance, the new Shepard launched on the 14th of this month. So I would have reported on this last week. But the new Shepard is a rocket that's launched by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is a company that's owned by Jeff Bezos, one of the richest guys in the world, who also owns Amazon. So one of his side projects is the company Blue Origin, and he's trying to develop the suborbital spacecraft that will eventually take passengers up 100 miles into space and back again and land there. Pretty much where they took off from, and this happens in West Texas. He's also building an orbital spacecraft, which is under development in Florida, and he's building the engines for that in Alabama. But the new Shepard made another flight. He's gone through about four or five different upgrades to the new Shepard. And this was the latest one, the 14th launch overall. Also with a new spacecraft that will eventually hold people. For now, it's completed all new interior, new communication equipment, and most importantly, heating, air conditioning, humidity control, complete environmental system was put on his final flight. The other 13 flights he had, somewhat in that direction, but this one would be a complete spacecraft with chairs and big windows. Over it to see how it does. They've done that before, but they put this one in that spacecraft as well. It successfully took off. Went up past the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers, a little over 60 miles high. The booster itself separates from the spacecraft. This whole system is reusable. The booster winds up coming down first. The spacecraft itself has three big parachutes that open up and float slowly down to Earth. But the first thing to get back is the booster. Came back right onto a pad there, so right on the money. Right before it lands, the single engine reignites, and it landed successfully. They use liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. It's called a BE-3 engine. So it's flown 14 times. The BE-3 engine will have a future even after this whole rocket program is over, because that will be used as a second stage for the New Glenn engine. The New Glenn spacecraft is going to be relatively big, almost the size of a Saturn V rocket. But that's under development, so that will eventually have the BE-4 engines, many of them launching New Glenn into space, and then you'll take the same engine now that's functioned 14 times now for a second stage. So he's got a plan. For now, his plan is to try to come up with people eventually to fly in this thing. And estimated cost will probably be around $200,000, less our herd. So naturally, this is not for the average person. You probably have to have a lot of money sitting around that you really want to get rid of. So it's going to bring in the wealthy and six people at a time with no pilot. Eventually, what's going to happen here is, like, eventually you'll have numbers 15 and 16 go up. I think around number 17 they're going to put a pilot and a commander in the spacecraft and see how it does for a couple of flights. And then once they get comfortable with it, you're able to put passengers on. And they claim six passengers without a pilot. It's all going to be automatic. You'll go up to past the Kármán line. You'll be officially an astronaut. You'll be in space. You'll get a few minutes of zero G. You'll get to see the Earth like not too many people have seen. And then you'll come back down on your in the spacecraft. The booster will land separately. And they show the booster booster come down, and then they show the spacecraft come down, landed right next to a road. This truck comes out, and we'll be able to open the door and pick all the people up and bring them back to safety and get on your airplane and fly back home. So I'm waiting to see that happen. Hopefully they'll get a launch with a couple of astronauts in there by the end of this year. And it looks like they might be able to do that, but we'll see. It's in the cards, and we'll be looking forward to that. Any questions before I just move on to the next topic? This is WS2N. Okay, I got to remember to unkey long on a 4 for anybody on Echo Link. Nothing heard. There's a spacecraft on Mars that's been there a couple of years now. It launched almost 3 years ago, called InSight. And what InSight was, it wasn't a rover, so it went to Mars. It didn't have an orbiter attached to it. It launched here from Earth on an Atlas, Atlas 5, 401, that meant the 4 stood for the diameter, set up on the nose, which encapsulated the InSight spacecraft, and the zero meant that they didn't have any extra boosters attached to it, and the one was for the second stage. Well, it got to Mars successfully, landed. It had on board two main experiments. One, it was a seismometer and a robotic arm, and put the seismometer onto the surface of Mars, and everything's been working fine with that. It detected many Mars quakes over the last couple of years. But the other experiment they had was the heat probe that was going to be hammer itself into the Mars surface. It was like a mole, around 16 inches tall, and inside it had this heavy weight and this motor that would turn, and it would push up against the spring, and then once it got to a certain point, the motor was turning a piece that was on a cam, and once it went off that cam, the spring would be energized and would force its weight down into the air, into the nose of the mole. So it was a self-hammering mole. If you look at it from the outside, it wouldn't look like there was anything moving in it, but inside this motor was moving with this heavy weight, and it was hammering itself into the surface of Mars. And the idea was to go down 3 meters, roughly 15 feet, and drag behind it this cable. It looked like ladder line, this flat cable, which powered it, and also had data cable going up to the spacecraft. And the idea was to take temperatures all the way down to 15 feet, and they would get the different numbers, and then they would be able to extrapolate and tell you exactly what the temperatures were all the way down to the center of the planet by having that information. Well, it never worked out. The company that worked for Germany was instrumental in this heat probe. Officially, they called it the heat flow physical properties package. So they called it HP3. They worked on it. The German Space Agency, DLR. DLR is the equivalent of NASA for Germany, and they contributed to this whole deal. And they worked on it for over a year and a half. Different ways of trying to do it. Pushing down the soil with a robotic arm, trying to create more friction. It would work a little bit, but then it would get stuck. Thought maybe there was a rock underneath, but they realized it wasn't, because it did go down a little bit. And the soil just was not, it was too fluffy. They didn't have enough friction to grab it. So they took the robotic arm and they put it on top of the probe, and this way they were able to get it in a little bit deeper. It was almost, the last time I saw a picture, it was just on the ground, so they got it down like 16 inches. But then it stopped, and they finally gave up on this whole idea. But they learned a lot from it if they get another chance. And this time they'll, or next time, I think they'll have a good shot at completing that. They've tried this type of thing before. They tried on another spacecraft that, you know, was, when it was going down to the surface. They shot these two probes out. They thought it would penetrate the surface, and that never materialized either. But next time around, next time they have a landing craft, I'm sure they'll get involved with NASA to try to duplicate something like that. I believe the European Space Agency's rover, which was delayed, it was supposed to go this year, it was delayed by 2 years because they have parachute problems, might have something similar. They're going to try to do that with that rover once that lands in 2 years from now. So that's the story on the heat probe. They finally gave up on that, and we'll pick it up again 2 years from now if they're ever able to do that. But meanwhile, the other experiments that they did have on InSight did work out. The NASA seismometer worked out great. Still working today. Any questions before I move on? WS1. Okay, another drilling type of story, but not on Mars. This one will have to do with the moon. The plan on the future of lunar missions, especially manned missions, will be to set up some sort of a base, and they would like to set it up on the south side of the moon, or the South Pole. There's a couple of good reasons for it. One is because of the tilt of the moon, you know, like the Earth, we tilted 22.5 degrees, off the ecliptic. The moon tilts about 1.5 degrees. It's not much, but it's something. So a lot of times when a moon is... when we're looking at the moon, you pretty much always see the southern tip of the moon, which means light is always hitting them. It would be a great place to set up a base. You could set up solar panels to create electricity. Eventually, they plan on having nuclear fission for generators. They have these 10-kilowatt generators they're thinking about, but in the beginning, they're going to need solar panels. And the other reason for going to the south part of the moon is because they would like to get into the dark craters. They believe down in the dark craters that have never seen light, you know, for billions of years, there's not only water there, well, there's no water, but there's ice, from all the comets and everything that hit over the centuries, over the eons of time. They believe there's ice in these craters that they could eventually mine, bring up the ice, water to drink eventually, you'll be able to use electrolysis, be able to have hydrogen for fuel, oxygen to breathe, and eventually use both of them if you could make enough of it to resupply spacecraft. And with different chemical processing, you could also probably create methane. So you'll be able to have, if you have a liquid hydrogen rocket, you'll be able to refuel that. Or a liquid methane rocket, you'll be able to refuel that. Well, the rocket that will be, or the lander that they plan on sending to the moon by the end of this year, is called, it's a company Intuitive is the name of the company. They have this moon lander called Nova C. Nova C will land on the south part of the moon. They needed a company to get them there. They don't make their own rockets to launch from Earth, so they're going to hire SpaceX, which is, of course, very successful at launching rockets, not only here, but also to deep space. So Intuitive plans on landing on the moon, and it will have a drill, and they'll drill into the lunar surface to figure out what kind of water or, you know, not real water, but ice particles that might be under the surface in the southern part of the moon. And this thing stands about 10 feet tall, this whole lander, and about 6 feet wide. So it's a good size lander. It will be fueled by liquid oxygen and liquid methane. So like I said before, the ultimate goal is maybe to eventually refuel these types of things. This particular rocket has the capability of landing and eventually taking off, and they could actually move to another spot, multiple launches from the moon. The reason they know they could do that, this came from this engineering came from a NASA project they had years ago, which we covered here on the net, called the Morpheus Project. Morpheus was a NASA project that they had in Florida, and they used to launch these vehicles, and they would fly a couple hundred feet down, you know, down the air, rode a piece, and then they'd come back down, and they would land, and had all kinds of cameras on board, and the cameras would tell the computer on board, you know, what the surface was like. It would be able to figure out where it was, and it would be able to come down right between these different boulders. Computers made that evaluation real quick, and it worked out quite successfully. So they feel they dropped eventually the Morpheus project, but this company, Intuitive Machines, picked up on a Morpheus project, and they developed it. And sure enough, at the end of this year, well, maybe sometimes things are delayed, maybe early next year. I think probably December or so, they might have a launch with SpaceX to the moon. It doesn't have a rover on board, but it does have a capability of drilling into the lunar surface. Later versions of Nova C will eventually be able to bring other equipment, including small rovers, to the moon. So that's the story on that company. I haven't talked about that at all on the net, but we'll see how they do. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, here's another topic, a little bit more down to earth. SpaceX, of course, is always in the news. Their goal is to launch in the future Starship. Starship will eventually develop over time. They've had a couple of test versions go up so far, a couple of hops, they call them hops, launched from Boca Chica, Texas. The early hops, you know, they flew maybe 500 feet into the air, and they moved over, translated over, and landed back down on a designated launch pad. And they had a couple of those, and then they had one about a month or so ago, called SN8, serial number 8. It launched from the same place. This time it went 10 kilometers high. You know, it's like 6 miles high. The three engines shut off. Eventually the thing started to do a belly flop, coming back down toward Earth. It got very close to Earth. Three engines relit. It had a little nitrogen thrusters on board to straighten itself out a little bit, help bring it completely level. Did a vertical landing, almost dead center. It to this landing pad that they had, you know, maybe, you know, a couple thousand feet away from where it took off from. But unfortunately, one of the tanks inside collapsed, created like a vacuum inside, and the methane tank collapsed, and it blew up on a pad. But they got enough information out of that flight to move on to SN9, which probably will take off and do the same exact thing this week, except this time they plan on landing properly. Ultimate goal is to create Starship version, which will be able to actually go into orbit. And this will actually, the whole setup will actually be a second stage of what will be a much bigger version of this thing, called the Super Heavy, which will, between the Super Heavy and you put this thing on top, it'll be as big as the Saturn V rocket, maybe 400 feet tall. And that will eventually be able to fly people to the, not only to the moon, but to Mars. I mean, you know, bring people there. But Elon Musk knows that to launch these things from either Boca Chica, Texas, or Florida on a regular basis will be out of the question. You know, every now and then they, you know, get the FAA to approve clearing for miles around, make sure there's no planes, boats, or anything around. And he wants to fly these things a lot. So he got the bright idea, well, maybe we'll launch these things from out in the middle of the water somewhere. So recently he went out and purchased two oil rigs, two floating oil rigs that aren't being used anymore. But, you know, these things are massive. I saw them being towed into port. And his goal is to, you know, I guess strip everything off here and create a launch pad out of these two used oil rigs. And he's already named them. He put the name on the side of these things. You know, after they're done, by the way, they're going to float them out to sea. And you'll be able to launch rockets from, you know, miles and miles out, away from people, away from ships, away from airplanes. And his ultimate goal is to launch starships from this thing. So, you know, it's a long ways from that happening. He's still developing the starship. But, you know, he's thinking ahead. Bought up these two things. They said next to nothing. I don't know what it costs, what that means. So they renamed these Phobos and Deimos, the names of the two moons of Mars. This guy, of course, is obsessed with going to Mars, so he named it after the two moons. So I thought that was interesting. Any comments or questions? WS2N for the space portion of the Technic. Okay, very good. Nothing on that. There's a four-person crew. This I wanted to bring up as well. You know, anybody who's followed the net or the news knows right now there's a four-person crew that was sent up. They've been up for a couple of months now. Sent up on a Dragon crew vehicle launched by SpaceX on a Falcon 9 rocket. And they've been up there with three other astronauts, two Russians and another American astronaut, Kate Rubin. So, you know, you have seven people up there living there, working there, experiments, plenty of science coming down every time they send one of these cargo vehicles up. But this system that SpaceX has worked out. There's supposed to actually be two different companies, SpaceX and the United Launch Alliance, which is a consortium of Lockheed and Boeing. They're supposed to be sending crews up as well, but they're a little delayed right now. But eventually they'll be sending up a crew of four people too, but for now, they have another crew scheduled to launch in April to go up to the International Space Station with a brand new crew. April 20th is the launch date. And they're going to be launching before the other crew that went up comes back. So temporarily, I guess they're going to have 8, 9, 10, 11 people maybe up there. But then a week or two after the new crew arrives, the old crew will launch from the International Space Station on dock. Right now they're attached to the ITER docking piece of equipment. ITER is the International Docking Adapter. That's attached to the pressure mating adapter, which is attached to the Harmony node module. And they'll eventually leave that, and they'll come back, and well, presently they're scheduled to land in the Atlantic Ocean, where SpaceX has their ship to pick them up, and that'll be in late April. Or if there's rough waters, which happens a lot in the Atlantic, they have a plan B to land in the Gulf of Mexico, which is where the last crew landed. The last crew was a crew of two hams, by the way, Bob Mencken and Hurley. Correction, one guy was a ham, the other guy wasn't a ham. And they landed in the Gulf of Mexico. And so they have that option. But, things are really working. Things are happening as far as that goes. It's getting to the point where SpaceX is actually planning on launching paid commercial visitors to the space station, which could happen probably 2023 or something like that, I think. But they have plans of doing that. And Russia does it as well, but they're still sending up three at a time in a tightly packed Soyuz spacecraft. Dragon is a little bit more roomy, and eventually, if I have time, I'll talk about the Starliner that Boeing is building, and should have been ready by now, but they have been delayed. Anyway, any questions or comments? Anybody? Okay, in fact, a company called Axiom, and they have this Axiom company has plans on putting up their own module, or a couple of modules, to extend the space station, and their ultimate goal is someday the existing space station will have to be deorbited, and then relatively new modules will be able to separate from the existing space station, and they plan on creating their own commercial space station. Axiom will probably launch their own people. They plan on launching people to the space station. Again, having paid people pay them to go up to the space station, and they plan on using SpaceX to accomplish that. They plan on having one astronaut and three paid citizens going up to the space station. So I don't know how I feel about all that, but I guess it's only a matter of time. When planes started flying, it was only the rich that got to fly, and eventually, you can go to Kennedy Airport, take off, you have to go somewhere. Most people could afford to do that nowadays. Now, millions of people flying a year, and I guess someday in the future, you're gonna have millions of people flying to space. So, what are you going to do? Any comments or questions? Paul? That's Roy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out Frank tried to get in. You really have to let it the carrier drop for a little bit longer for him to get a chance.
Okay. I was good in the beginning, but sorry about that. Let's wait for Frank. WS2N.
WB2BXO here. Are you guys hearing me now?
Yes, very good, Frank. Sorry about that. WB2BXO, go ahead.
Leaving long enough pauses, there's something else, probably a noise burst periodically keying the repeater, so even if you wait a 30 seconds or so, it's still difficult to get in. In any case, you know, I've watched I think both Thursday and Friday, I think it was Thursday, watched the SN9 launch countdown, and the FAA scrubbed their launch for some reason. There seems to be a lot of controversy as to just what that was about, why the FAA, get my alphabet agency straight, the FAA evidently pulled their clearance at their last minute. I wonder if any of the aviation buffs on here have any idea what that was all about. Go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, you know, they were ready to go, and they, you know, they well, you know what happened with, a week or so ago, they fired the rocket engines, you know, as a test. They have everything locked down. And two of them needed to be replaced, two of the engines. There's three engines. So time went by, and then they had clearance for that next week. And then they, you know, then test with the engines and everything was fine. So then they you know, they're ready for launch. And something happened with you know, I you know, it might have been a bureaucracy thing, but I was listening to the guys talking about it, and it looked like they delayed it, but for an unknown reason, and then they said, okay, no, now you can go, and then they stopped it again. So I don't know if there was airplanes nearby or what caused that. So it looks like anyway they have another window of opportunity this week, so I plan on hopefully I can see that live. I saw the last one live. That was pretty cool. SN8, when it went up, and they had pictures all the way up. It went all the way up to the 6 mile or 10 kilometer area, and then came all the way back and blew up on the landing pad. So hopefully it works out, and I might have been a bureaucracy problem. I don't know. We'll see. But I haven't heard anything lately. That's what I've heard so far. Back to you, Brian.
Yeah, I know Elon Musk put up some tweets that he was out about it. Their system just isn't equipped to handle launches every week. They're equipped to handle a couple of launches per year of expendable rockets and just can't process the paperwork fast enough for them. I don't know. Anyway, interesting. Yeah, when is the next launch window? Is it tomorrow? I've heard a couple of different days. Tomorrow or Wednesday? Kind of hoping it's tomorrow. Probably stuck in the house all day. Good.
Last I heard was tomorrow, but you know, you never know with the weather, wind, very windy down there, you know, if it's delayed another day or two, but I'm expecting sometime next week, but I'll start looking for it tomorrow. I wonder if you go to Las Padre, is the website that you ordered, you know, I guess it's what, YouTube, that you go to when you put in Las Padre. They always have the guy's talking about it. For some reason, they don't put these launches, these test launches, on the SpaceX webcast. You know, when you watch a Falcon 9 go up, for instance, whatever it might be, Falcon 9, or Falcon Heavy, or you know, even their test flights with launch abort systems, they were always on the NASA webcast, you know. But for some reason, these missions, these experimental test missions down in Boca Chica, they're not. But you can see them on Las Padre. I wonder if you go on that one. Back to you.
Yeah, there are a couple of everyday astronaut runs them. Google Space runs them, though without commentary. Everyday astronaut, I think that's Marcus House, unless I'm confusing him with the angry astronaut. But I think that his commentary is funny. He's good. And he came on one of his webcasts, by the way, all banged up because while he was packing up his gear on Boca Chica Beach after one of the tests, some kid racing his car on the beach slammed into him. He called the cops. I don't know if you've seen this one. The kid who slammed into wrecked his car had no registration, no driver's license, and the local cops just told him to go home. Didn't even write him a ticket. Is that nuts or what?
KD2OCB, question?
Oh, okay. And, yeah, well, you know, that's Texas. And I thought you said... But we'll go to the question in a second. I just want to find out. There was a quick dropout. Did you say it was the everyday astronaut, that guy?
Yeah, I think he was everyday astronaut whose car got clobbered while he was packing up his gear a week or two ago. I think he was talking about it on one of his podcasts.
Okay, yeah, Tim. He's quite a character. Comes from Iowa, middle of the country, but a very knowledgeable guy. Okay, hope we didn't get too banged up. Okay, the other question, we'll go back to you. This is WS2N, Paul.
Well, if the guy had no driver's license and no registration, how about insurance? Did he have that, too?
Pick it up, Frank.
Well, as I understand it, and you can probably find it on Everyday Astronauts page, as I understand it, the guy had no insurance, no registration. Obviously, he had no registration and no license. He had no insurance, either. I forget whether he said it was a 15-year-old kid or 17-year-old kid. Anyway, some underage kid racing on the beach who clobbered him as he was leaving the beach. anyway, if I, that's the end. So, no, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure he's really the guy. This guy had no insurance, of course, either.
Okay, yeah, dangerous. Those guys are sticking in that guy. You know, there's all kinds of... They got skeeters as big as birds and freaking alligators and who knows what's in those woods that are wandering around. But they do a good job. Then there's somebody by the name of Mary. Now, Mary actually lives down in Boca Chica. And that's how they get most of the... You know, I would say most of their pictures... She photographs everything when she's down there. And they get all the close-ups of the all the different rockets and things that they're building. I mean, this place it's come a long way in 1 year. They have gigantic tank bombs, and now he's building another setup where you could if they're going to start manufacturing their own oxygen and methane, you know, to get oxygen and methane to this place, you have to have that
ship time
complete. I mean, you're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of this stuff, liquid methane, liquid oxygen. So that I have, he's building a plant to take the, he's going to chill the air with liquid nitrogen. And then he's going to use the liquid nitrogen. He's going to chill the air to get liquid nitrogen out of the air. And then he's going to take that liquid nitrogen and he's going to cool methane that's coming out of the ground. He's right near a location where methane actually comes out of the ground. He's going to cool that down to liquid temperature using liquid nitrogen. And then he's going to be able to refuel his rocket. See, he's quite a character, this Elon Musk. Unbelievable. All right, any other questions or comments? WS2M. Okay. Let me just talk about the EVA. The EVA that they did last week was somewhat successful. It went out of the Quest Lab, and two of the seven people that were up there. The idea was to go over to where the Columbus module is. There's a million different modules up there, let's say. Not a million, but, you know, different modules were by different countries. We have the Kaibo module set up with Japan, and we have Destiny for the United States, Russia, Zvezda, and, one of the modules is called Columbus module by European Space Agency. And they had brought up a SpaceX cargo vehicle last year. This Bartolomeo set up like an outdoor patio, you might call it, that's attached to the Columbus module. And they'll be able to put experiments out there and do all kinds of work with it. But they needed to power it up, put data cables there. So the EVA took care of that. They went over to that, which is, you know, at the end of the whole space station, and put in some cables. There is one cable that is stuck. They can't get the thing open. They're going to have to work on that and figure out why that thing is not cooperating. And the next EVA, they'll go out and I'm sure they'll get that working. But, you know, it was successful. And they put a new KA band, so that, you know, KA is really high frequency, which will allow a tremendous amount of bandwidth to be sent down to Earth. The European Space Agency wants that, needs that bandwidth for the experiments that they're doing inside Columbus module and on this outdoor patio-like setup where these experiments could be exposed to the vacuum of space. So that's the story on that. Looking at the time, I'm going to close it down. I won't close it down. Roy will do that. I'll pass it back to Roy to pick up the end of the net. And tomorrow, let me drop it. Tomorrow is Monday. I think a lot of us are going to be home with all the snow we're going to get. But tomorrow night is club information net at 8:30, followed by the swap and shop, and then followed by Newsline after that. So you can tune into these frequencies for that. You can check in. You don't have to be a club member. And we'll turn it over to Roy. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul. This is AC2GS. And as always, I want to thank Paul for this SpaceNet report and his participation, and Andy, WA2DL, for Andy's Corner and his participation, and a big thank you to everyone out there who participated tonight, As I often say, participants make or break a technical net. You know, otherwise, I'm just left talking to myself. So I do appreciate all of you, and I hope you come back next Sunday night at 8 o'clock when we'll do it all over again. Before we leave, I want to remind you that if you have any questions,